Welcome to the Foolish Adventure Show, where guru hype is banned, lifetime value of a customer is king, and the internet business has replaced the J-O-B as the path to financial success and personal freedom. Now, here's straight talk about making a living online with your host, Tim Conley.
Welcome to another episode of the Foolish Adventure Show. I've got my good friend, Mr. Rob Walling of StartupsForTheRestOfUs.com and SoftwareByRob.com. And we're going to have a little chat about how to market and sell software in today's world. I got started in the marketing of software back in 1999. And 2000, and it's a completely different world from when I was helping companies sell software back in the early 2000s. So I wanted to bring on an expert who is actively marketing his own software, Mr. Rob Walling. So what's up, Rob?
What's up, Tim? Thanks for having me on back on the show.
Man, it's great having you back on. Like I said, I love doing the show because I get the chance to just sit down and chat with really smart people, and I get to learn a lot. And hopefully my listeners get to learn a ton. So I'm going to just grill you on the best ways of marketing software today. And you, before we hit record, you brought up there's a few categories. So what are those categories of software, and why is there a distinction that we need to make regarding marketing?
Sure. When someone's listening to this podcast, they might not have a lot of software knowledge themselves to actually build the software, so they may need to hire someone, or they're likely working a full-time job and going to need to do it on the side. So with those constraints in mind, there are really only three or four categories of software that I would recommend they even consider. I'll make it four categories. It's iOS apps, WordPress plugins or themes, some kind of downloadable software, and then SaaS apps. That's software as a service apps, which are web applications that someone pays a subscription to use. And the reason I limit it to those four is you can go outside of that. You can build enterprise software. You can build embeddable systems. I mean, there's 10 other types. But those are just they're so complicated. They're so hard to market. They're not something for a beginner to even consider. Now, in this conversation, we'll probably focus more on the WordPress and the downloadable stuff. To be honest, SaaS apps are great. I love SaaS apps, but they are a much more advanced monster. They require more software expertise than the other types. They require more ongoing support because you have a 24/7 service people are using. So it's something that I recommend if you're a software person yourself that you could do it, or if you already have some other successful software products that you can then move on to that subscription model of SaaS apps. But if you are beginning, I recommend you stay with the others. In terms of iOS apps, the reason I'm probably not going to dive into it too much is iOS apps have this whole different paradigm of marketing. And you and I talked a little bit either on the last podcast or offline about it, but it's hit-based marketing. It's kind of luck. I'll put quotes around. It's like luck-based, because when you're selling something for 99 cents or $4, you don't have money to really market. You don't have money to do pay-per-click. You don't have money to advertise. You don't have money to create a repeatable, sustainable process. So you're reliant on catching a viral wave or being featured in the iOS App Store. It's hit-based as much as recording a song or building a video game is. It's more about entertainment than about using repeatable marketing approaches like we can do with WordPress plugins, downloadable software, and SaaS apps.
Right. With the iOS apps, from the outside, it looks like a lot of the marketing just takes place in this marketplace. It's like its own little ecosystem, and that it's hard to do stuff outside of that to drive any real change or effect inside that market system.
Yeah, what I've noticed is that the people who have a lot of success with iOS apps, they either got in very early and they were one of the few in that category from the start, and now that you just have momentum that builds, and that's great for them. They have this awesome, it's kind of like ranking one in Google for a really hard term. You know, if you rank number one for credit cards, you have this momentum that keeps going, and that's great. The other thing I've seen work for people is if they get a network of apps going, and again, they've been around quite a long time. So maybe they have 10 or 20 apps and they cross promote like crazy. That's why every app has that more apps, you know, button on the homepage, because they get a lot of sales from that. Aside from those two approaches, which required you to either, you know, requires you to kind of acquire a whole network or to have started early, it's there aren't a lot of repeatable, predictable marketing approaches that you can do with iOS apps, because you just can't afford to do it because the lifetime value of customers are too low right now.
Right, right. And we're already seeing some of those early players are having trouble financially. They grew really large and now their customer base is starting to depart.
Right, right. And the growth of iOS or of, well, Android's continuing a really steep growth curve, but the growth of iOS is slowing down. Now, it's not to say it's stopped. It's still doing, you know, growing very quickly. But if you're selling one-time software downloads for 99 cents or $4.99, you need just rocket ship growth to make a lot of money at that. And as the growth flatlines, you need to figure out a way to get more money from the customers you already have. You might have 10, 20, 30,000 customers, but if they're not paying you any repeatable money, you can't just maintain that app forever, right? You can't keep offering upgrades. So you either have to build new things that you sell to them, or you get in-app purchases, or you try to figure out a subscription model. No one that I know, no big player has figured out a subscription model. So they're doing a lot of in-app purchases and cross promotion, which is okay. It works, like I said, but it's just not something you can dive into as easily as, say, building a WordPress plugin, building downloadable software or a SaaS app. You can do that today, enter the market, and actually follow best practices that are highly likely, or they are likely to lead to, you know, having a successful app. Whereas the iOS stuff and all mobile apps are they're just a little less predictable.
Okay, then we should get into something that is predictable. So I know you're putting a lot of emphasis on people who are new into the software world, sure. But I don't want us to neglect the people who are actually doing a software business. I want them to be able to get something out of this conversation too. So we have a couple of other things for us. Downloadable, which I really thought was kind of going away.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't think that there was too many people doing that, though. I just bought, I believe it's called Scrivener, to do some typing because I'm working on a book right now, and I got it. And I'm downloading it, and I'm like, man, why do I need to download this? This thing really needs to be shareable between all my different computers. So if I want to write on this book while I'm out and I've got my MacBook Air, I want to be able to sit at the coffee shop and do that there, or sit at my desktop when I'm at home and write there.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be nice if it was cloud-based, but no, I'm downloading it.
Yeah, that is kind of crazy in this day and age, actually. So downloadable software is absolutely going, it's just going away in favor of mobile and web-based software. So downloadable stuff can be both desktop apps like you're talking about. It can also be software that you download and run on a server. So one of my products is called .NET Invoice, and it's actually a web application that you pay a one-time fee for. You download it and then you run it on a web server and it does your invoicing for you. So you kind of have your own private FreshBooks is what it's like, right? Okay. You have your own little instance. However, with that said, I wouldn't really recommend people enter that market either, because there's just a bunch of negatives to it. It's one-time purchases, so you have to charge quite a bit of money, and that means, you know, fewer people will buy it. Whereas if you turn that into a SaaS app and you can compete, you can get that recurring revenue. In addition, the support is such a pain because people have different configurations. Often they'll have something screwed up on their server or on their desktop, and then they want you to help them with it, but it chews through a lot of your time. Whereas having a SaaS app or, you know, hopefully a WordPress plugin is less support time.
Right. So. And your customer support, you could charge for it, but a lot of people get upset when they're paying support for something that they believe is the software's fault.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And it's you can never prove that it's not the software's fault until you've troubleshot it and you spend the hours to do it. I mean, I've done this over and over. I used to do it when I was still doing support with .NET Invoice. And you'd spend an hour or two and find out, oh, their server's misconfigured. But what do you do now? You know, they're not going to pay you for that time you've spent.
Right.
And if you charge them up front, I mean, you know, the way Microsoft handles that or large companies is they say, all right, we're going to charge you $250 for a support ticket. If it's our fault, if it's a bug on Microsoft's part, we'll refund your money. But as a small player, that's just not going to fly and people are going to ask for a refund. So
right.
you have a choice to make. It puts you in, you know, kind of between a rock and a hard place, to be honest. So I'm not saying I'm not discounting iOS software, iOS apps. I'm not discounting downloadable software. But if you really can pick from the start, then you really need to, you know, I think choose the ideal scenario, which is to have some type of recurring revenue or to start with, you know, a nice ecosystem, which is something like WordPress.
With WordPress, a lot of the plugins out there are downloadable. You download it on and you install it into your WordPress site.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of those come with an annual license.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the part that makes it recurring, mm-hmm. though not as steady as something like a SaaS app where you're getting paid every single month for that. What are the special considerations with, say, a plugin that's downloadable versus some other kind of software that's downloadable?
Yeah, the nice part about WordPress plugins, you get a couple benefits from it that they're kind of like nice training wheels. And I mean that in a good way, not in a pejorative manner. The first thing you get is a lot of WordPress installations are fairly standard because they're, you know, people do the one click or they just download it and upload WordPress. Although you can have plugin conflicts, in general, it's a much more standardized installation base than someone's desktop computer or a server. And so you tend to run into less support issues because there's just more standardization. The other thing that you get is you get this awesome source of traffic. You get the WordPress.org search engine. You know, there you go to WordPress.org, search for plugins, you're in that directory, and that's a nice flywheel of traffic, just like the iOS App Store is, just like Google can be, just like ranking high in Amazon, just like ranking high in YouTube. There are just a handful, maybe 10, really solid, high-value sources of traffic that I know about, and the WordPress store is one of them. And so, well, those are the two things you get. The other consideration is plugins are, you're right, they are a one-time fee. The annual licenses are, they're nice. I've heard that the renewal rate is not as high as people would like, so you do have quite a bit of churn. But WordPress plugins and things similar to that, any type of ecosystem plugin where, you know, it can be Joomla or it can be Drupal or, you know, there's a lot of different apps out there that you can kind of latch onto. Any of those are going to be a nice way to get started and to enter into software without having to build a full-fledged SaaS app. And although I see it as like a stepping stone, right? You interviewed John Turner a month or two ago, and uh-huh. Then I have a number of friends who have WordPress plugins that make several thousand dollars a month. It's not truly recurring revenue, but that's a great thing to get started with because that allows you to either move down to part-time in your job, because you now replace some income, or it allows you to take that money and reinvest it into building something that can then get you some recurring revenue. So it's a nice kind of stepping stone or a step ladder up this chain of, you know, of high value software.
Yeah, and it'd be smart if you are building a plugin that can actually grow into an ecosystem of its own, where you start you create another plugin that serves another segment within that same target market, you know, the same customers that you've already gotten, you serve them something else. So if you're doing something that integrates with email autoresponders, well, then maybe you have something that then works with pop-ups or works with a webinar software or something. You could start building out an entire ecosystem around the theme of email.
Absolutely. And yeah, the more, I mean, once you have, you know, 80, 90,000 free downloads of a plugin and then you offer a premium option, you're going to get to a certain revenue level with that. And there's a certain amount of recurring revenue from the traffic coming from WordPress. But you're exactly right. As soon as you build another premium plugin that applies to that same audience, you're basically doubling your chances of revenue. Hopefully you will double your revenue. And if you add a few more to those, it becomes you've now built a little ecosystem that serves that market. And that's definitely a good way to go.
Okay, before we actually start getting into how to actually market software, let's jump on over to the one that you're not recommending for newbies, but it's the direction that everything's going, and that's SaaS apps.
That's right. I don't recommend it for newbies only because there's just a lot to building a SaaS app. Not only do you have to really build a nice marketing website, but you have to write all the code on the back end. You have to handle billing yourself. You have to maintain this app 24/7. It's not cheap to get a SaaS app off the ground compared to these other options. If you have software experience, I mean, this is what I do now, right? This is all I do is SaaS apps because I do see it as kind of the golden ticket, but it's just kind of more advanced level to jump up to if this is your first gig getting into software.
Yeah, and there's also that the trickle of income because you're getting paid monthly.
That's right. Yep. So if you can sell a WordPress plugin, I mean, I know some WordPress plugins that sell for, you know, maybe there's a $50 license, a $100 license, and a $250 license. So you don't need a lot of those sales to get up to a few thousand a month, whereas a lot of SaaS apps may have a $10, $20, and $40 plan. You need to build that for a long time. It's a long runway to build that into a $5,000 business.
Right. And though some people will give a slight discount if you pay annually so that they can get some money now and help grow the business, because you need that cash to then go back and do marketing. If you're waiting to build up a sizable customer base, it can take even longer because you don't have the cash going towards marketing to drive more people into your sales funnel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right.
All right. So let's kind of go back through and if I think we should cover like some general guidelines in marketing software, like what we should be thinking about, what we should be working on, and then maybe some actual specifics for, say, a WordPress plugin, and then for a SaaS app.
Okay, very good. I think to give kind of a broad brush, let's compare marketing information products or training courses versus marketing software. There are actually a lot of similarities. A lot of overlap in terms of the fundamentals never change, right? It's about creating confidence in the buyer. It's creating social proof. So it's things like testimonials, appearances, mentioning appearances in the press, anything that you can do to build your reputation. All of that applies to both of these. What I found is that marketing software using long-form sales letters, using relationships, kind of community building and then marketing software to them, it works a little differently. Like info products, that's kind of the way everybody's doing it now, right? Is you start a podcast or a blog, you build up an audience, and then you market some training courses or a membership website. And software, I think if you're going to invest the time to build software and to maintain it, that you need to think a little larger than that. You can definitely build a community and build a personal brand around it. But more importantly, it's about thinking about repeatable, scalable things that will work long term. So it's like finding these flywheels of traffic that don't depend on you just building an audience and maintaining an audience, if that makes sense. So it's other tactics that may not... that aren't commonly done, I'll say, with info product marketing.
Okay, so do you mean like just blogging? Because that requires a constant amount of creation.
Yeah, that is. I mean, blogging's not a bad thing. With a lot of software apps, I hire someone to write articles on a certain topic, but I'm doing it more for SEO because that builds a long-term stream of traffic rather than to build these blog posts where it goes viral and it creates this huge spike. Because if you're, let's say you're building an info product empire, or you just want to build, sell some info products to folks. You want to build an audience and sell them on an ebook or a membership website. Over time, you can just create content and build your list and then do a launch to them. And that launch, I mean, you and I both know, they can generate a lot of money, right?
I mean,
they can generate 50 grand or 100 grand or, you know, what, depending on the size of your list. Software products can work that way, but if you have a long-term mindset, they don't tend to work that way. You don't tend to make this huge splash with a big launch, and then, you know, you can kind of step back and ease up on the throttle for a long time. I view software product much more as long ball. It's like setting up the flywheel approaches that function over the long term. So it is things like SEO, it's getting mentioned in blog posts, guest posting, it's integrating with other software applications that can put you on an integrations page that sends you traffic over the long term. It's doing some paid acquisition. It's having the lifetime value to be able to do that, which is not something that you see many people doing these days with training courses and more knowledge products. And then there are some that overlap, certainly, like doing joint mailings and even appearing on podcasts, you know, doing kind of a press tour on podcasts. So yeah, that's the basic idea of how I view software marketing, is more looking at it as a repeatable business process. It's certainly early on, it's awesome to do those things that don't scale, you know, to go on podcasts and to do guest posts and that those kinds of things. And those build up your flywheels. But then long term, you really need to look, if you want to make the software product last for the long term, then you really need to think about what's going to sustain this thing, you know, over several years.
You know, yeah, that sounds like a lot of work, because I always thought it was just you had to just show up on the homepage of TechCrunch or Hacker News, and that was it. You were set.
That's it. No, you didn't. I know you don't think that way, but no, that's such a common misconception. I mean, I have a blog post called "Why a Link from TechCrunch Will Not Make You Rich," because there was this fallacy. I don't think it really exists anymore. Hopefully not. But there was this fallacy that all you needed was this big break. And that's the thing, is with info products, that might be the case, because you can get this spike in traffic and that's it, you know, and info products don't last forever, and you don't keep them around for 5 years, 10 years. But software products, that is the case, where that big link may get you a bunch of people coming to look at it, but to really convert those people into buyers and long-term customers and then build something that lasts for a long time is an entirely different ballgame. So I would recommend, and that's not the case with iOS apps, right? iOS apps are more of a short-term game where you're just looking for sales, whereas these other kind of WordPress plugins, SaaS apps, and potentially downloadable software, I think if you get into it and you think that you're going to make that big chunk of money with a single launch, you really have to know what you're doing, and you have to have a large audience to do that. Otherwise, it's definitely long ball, and you need to think about it in that way in order to be successful.
Right. I a little pop psychology just kind of jumped into my head on the startup world, is that they, because those are the people who are like, oh, I just need to get on Hacker News, I just need to get on TechCrunch, you know, that fallacy that was running around for a while. But if you look at it from their perspective, well, they got VC funding. That was like a big event. It just happened once. And wow, look, I've got all this money, I'm flush with cash. So now I need press. That's going to happen once, and I'll be flush with customers.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I think maybe that mentality and even the launch mentality in the info product world, it kind of has that too. I'm just going to get a big score and then I'm done. And a lot of people drop their service afterwards. And I think that's maybe where you're talking about with software, is that if you try to do a big launch, you have to be able to support that software afterwards. And if you just added 1,000 customers, you may not actually have the support structure behind it to serve that software.
That's right. That's a big difference between selling information versus software, is that there are real support costs. It will require a lot of time to support. Even if you build a good app, onboarding people, getting them going, you know, just supporting the app over time and fixing bugs as things change. You know, if you do any type of integration with Google or Twitter, any API, that's going to change over time. There's more ongoing maintenance, you know, is the bottom line.
Right. And I'm seeing for the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, a lot of marketers, especially people who are in the info marketing world, getting into software. And they have they're bringing this approach of instant wealth, and they don't have the support structures. And I don't even know if I should name like several, but there were some WordPress plugins that were done by marketers, that had a huge splash. And a few of them that I use and still use, but there was a time where they were going through this horrendous period of customer support where you wouldn't hear back from them for a couple of weeks. You would get an automated response saying, you'll hear back from us within 24 hours. And then you would email them two or three more times. And then finally, a week or two later, you would hear from them saying, yeah, we're working on that. We kind of know there's a bug there. We'll fix it eventually.
Yeah, that's tough. And that is potentially, acceptable with info products, or maybe you just wouldn't have gotten that many support calls, so it wouldn't have taken 2 weeks. But it doesn't work when you're actually using an app someone built, right? You just expect there to be more and better support than that.
Right, because with info product, nowadays, what's the worst kind of support you're going to have? I can't log in.
Yeah.
The video doesn't play on my iPad.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Outside of that, there's not too much else.
That's right. And that's where it's fairly easy to hire a VA to handle support for an info product. It's a little more complicated to do that with software because someone needs to know the software. It's not to say you can't train VAs, because I've done this, but it just takes more time and more of a concerted effort in order to get someone in that support role so that you're not answering the emails yourself.
Okay. So let's jump on over to... like, who are we going to sell to? Like, I'm about to make software. Who do I sell to?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think there's a lot of answers. I give what I recommend, right? So B2C, selling software B2C is not a great market because you're going to find mostly hobbyists, and you're going to be dealing with people who are very price sensitive. So consumers tend to be to buy based on price, absolute price. Businesses tend to buy based on value. There's a big difference between that, because if you save a business money or make them money, if you bring them more customers or save them time, you can charge a lot of money for your product because there's a value there. If you sell to consumers, they see something for $49 and they think, oh my gosh, I have to work X hours to get that, or that's, half of my cable subscription. I mean, they just put it in terms of absolute dollars and they don't value their time nearly as much. So my recommendation again, and what you see all my products focusing on, is small businesses. Sometimes medium-sized businesses creep in there, but they have a longer sales process. So it's, a lot like 37 Signals have talked about, they say the Fortune 5 million. And so, the millions of small businesses around the world. And there are tons of, consultancies and freelancers and all of those guys I would include in that small business market.
Right. Okay, so this is something that I just thought about, is in the plugin world, WordPress world, would those people be considered prosumers then? Because there's a lot of people that get into, I'm going to be a blogger, that's going to be my business, but they don't actually have a business, they don't have a business going, they don't have a business model, but they're still buying the exact same kind of plugins to run their blog. Would that be a prosumer, and would there be any difference in marketing to them?
Yeah, I would consider them more prosumers. If someone doesn't actually have revenue from some source, then they're not really a small business yet in my mind, because they aren't thinking yet about how valuable their time is. If they're just going to start a blog and blog for 6 months, their time still isn't that valuable. Whereas if you get a photographer, even someone who's just doing it on the side and making $1,000 a month as a wedding photographer, they are, in my mind, kind of the entry-level small business. And so they will buy a Pinterest plugin that helps track how many pins they get, or that helps people pin it, a pin it button or something like that. I do think that the marketing, I don't know. Yeah, I don't know how different the marketing needs to be to both those groups. I do think that a prosumer is just in general going to be much less likely to buy. And so I don't even know that I would target them with my marketing. Because if you're going to say buy, an AdWords ad or do a lot of guest posting, I guess you could go on to ProBlogger and CopyBlogger, and kind of do guest posting there. But your conversion rate on the people who come through, if they're prosumers rather than small businesses, they're just going to be lower, period. So if you have the choice, I would target the people who are more likely to buy, and that's going to be folks who do value their time, and if you can offer them that value proposition I talked about earlier, It's the low-hanging fruit of your marketing efforts.
Right. Well, because the reason I brought that up was that you had mentioned earlier that if you had 80,000 free downloads of your plugin that and you offered a premium version, that a portion of those people would become your customers. What I'm thinking is that a freemium model is going to attract the consumer and the prosumer first, as opposed to a business which already values their time. They value what they're going to get. They would rather just pay for something that works. That's like my approach. I go and I look at something and something that's brand new, and I think, man, that's actually kind of cool. I'm gonna wait until everyone else has come in and bought and the bugs are worked out so that I can come in and buy something that actually works.
Right. Yeah, I think there's enough stuff that's kind of at the cutting edge, Pinterest is one example, and there are certain integrations with Google and Twitter that are just, there just isn't that much competition there yet. And so you don't have the luxury of waiting. You know what I'm saying? So I guess the prosumer to small business market, I think small businesses will use new plugins. They will use free plugins if the thing is rated high enough and if they think someone will support it. And then once you do come out with that premium plugin, that premium version that upgrades that, a lot of your conversions, I would say most of your conversions, will be from those small business customers. So going the freemium model with WordPress is, I typically steer away from the freemium model in general. But with WordPress plugins, I think it's kind of the only way to go, because it just brings you to a broad audience, and it doesn't actually cost you that much aside from the support, because it's not like you're hosting a service that 50,000 people are using. You really just uploaded some code that 50,000 people are using. So it's a different cost structure from your end.
Right.
But what I've found, I've seen this model done over and over, and actually, you know, like you said, John Turner did it a month or two. You interviewed him a month or two ago. We talked about that. Most of the successful WordPress plugin folks that I know have a free plugin that's kind of builds their community, and that's their flywheel of traffic. And then they either do a premium version of that or they do premium add-ons to that.
Right.
And they do have a lot of prosumers using it, but most of their sales, there are some prosumers, but it's a lot of B to small B. I'm sorry. It's a lot of small businesses that are using it.
Right. I talk a lot about the three-product approach, 3PA, and using something to attract your market, like a product number one being a free product that has no barrier to entry. It doesn't require an email opt-in or anything. And that's kind of what the free plugins are. If you go to WordPress, you can take a look at it. Actually, you can do it from your admin. You just go in and you can install them immediately into your blog. That would be a way of doing it. And I watched Clay Collins recently launch his Lead Player video software, his plugin for WordPress. And it was what was cool about it was that he gave away a plugin that was related to generating leads. It was get email opt-ins. And he gave that one away, which is, I think it's used on Mixergy, where you have, you go to Mixergy, and then boom, you have an email opt-in. It takes up the entire page. You don't get to see the site yet. I can't remember what he's calling that particular thing. That way of giving away something that's related to your product, because it's still in the lead generation field, then the product that he came out with, he just sold it. There wasn't a freemium version of it.
Exactly. And that's a great market. It's kind of like giving away the razor to sell the blades type thing. You're gathering an audience around that, and you're showing, you know, if you give that first plugin away and you have the means to build that, meaning you have the money to build, you basically now have to build and support two plugins, and you're betting that second one is going to pay more than pay for this cost and support cost of that first free one. So the free one's going to tend to be simpler. But if you can do that, it's a calculated risk, right? That you're going to be able to sell enough of the second one to pay for the first. However, Clay is super smart. He knows what he's doing, and it's not hard for him to understand that value proposition and to execute well enough that it's definitely lucrative for him.
Right.
And so, yeah, I don't think it's actually, WordPress is kind of the exception where I think of the freemium model actually working reasonably well. Or like you said, it's that's more of a, almost like a, what do you call it? It's a cross sell is really what he's doing, right. Although he's giving away the initial, you know, he's cross selling to a free product he's giving away. And that's, I mean, that, yeah, I've done that similar things. And it does work once you know what you're doing. I think you can hurt yourself though early on if you don't really know what you're doing.
Right.
You can make some mistakes with that approach.
Right. Well, because something that I've been spending a lot of time thinking about lately is getting people off this hamster wheel of content creation. A lot of people are like, oh, put out lots of content. And of course, it's all got to be epic. Every piece of content that you put out has to be epic. And yet you've got to do tons of it. I don't even think that's possible to put out tons of epic content. But things like audience building through something like what Clay did, which was give away a free plugin. He built up by doing one thing as opposed to spreading out content for years. It's like, here's this thing, and it's and he made sure that it was related to the thing he was going to sell. But he used that one thing as his epic content to give away and build his target market around.
Right. And the nice part about what he's done with that WordPress plugin is that free one will now sit in the WordPress store, WordPress.org. It's the theme, you know, the search engine, uh-huh. Plugin search engine. He will continue to get downloads of that. And I bet in the dashboard when you install it, it'll say, hey, I also have this premium version, or not a premium version, but this other one that, you know, generates leads for you. It'll be a constant flywheel of traffic for him. So right. It wasn't just a one-time effort. Like you're saying, if you publish a blog post that's the epic content, it goes viral, you will get the spike. You'll get some search engine traffic over the years, but it's not likely going to convert well enough to really be worth all the time that you spent on it. The odds are against you over time doing that. Whereas releasing actual software that people can use is a different value prop. Like,
right.
it can work a lot better.
All right. So let's get into marketing some software then. Let's talk about and do it in concrete terms, if you don't mind. Let's
sure.
talk about Hittail. How do you sell Hittail?
So Hittail is a SaaS app, so it's a subscription model, and it helps website owners, startups, internet marketers, and e-commerce providers. It helps them figure out terms. It's the low-hanging fruit of search engine ranking. So it tells you the terms that you can rank for very easily, but you're not focusing on it. So it basically gives you the short list of terms and says, here, go write a blog post about these and it'll rank, or create some content for these terms and you'll rank high on Google. So that's the short answer of what it is. I acquired it about 18 months ago, and I relaunched it just under a year ago. And right from when I relaunched it, I did, it's a series of steps that I took. So the first thing I did is I did a bunch of stuff that doesn't scale. And that may sound bad, but that's what you have to do early on just to get some buzz, just to get a nice kind of block of revenue going. Because the more revenue you can generate, the more profit you can generate, the more money you have to play with later on. Even if you're going to do free marketing approaches like guest posting or well, SEO is not exactly free, but you know it can kind of be free, or blogging, any of that stuff. You can always get it done faster and better if you have some money to play with. So initially, I recommend that you go and you do a bunch of stuff that doesn't scale. So it was things like I did write a blog post about it, about my adventures relaunching it, and it went on Hacker News. I did write a bunch of guest posts, which totally do not scale, right? I'm not going to write 100 guest posts. There aren't even 100 blogs that I could guest post on, but I spent the time. Now, what I did is I had a little bit of money. So what I would do is put out an outline for the guest post. I hired a writer to write it. Then, and you know, I asked, it was basically a ghostwriter. And then I took their nugget of a post, and then I fleshed it out. So I didn't have to do all the work. I put in my own words, and then I would submit it to the site. So I saved myself a little bit of time there, quite a bit of time, by having a little bit of money to play with.
I want to interrupt for a second there. So having this ghostwriter create this content for you, which mm-hmm. I think is really smart, what was the cost for that? What did it take to have that person write this? And do you have an idea of how much time it actually saved you?
Yeah, the cost was most likely, or most likely the cost was between, depending on the length and the topic, it was between $50 and $75 to, I would create an outline, submit it to them, and then they would, you know, come back with a fleshed out post that I would then edit. It probably saved me about between 2 and 4 hours of time.
Okay.
For each post. So definitely worth, you know, worth it. I also, I mean, there are a lot of other things that don't scale that work well, like infographics. They're all the rage these days. They're getting to be, like, Google's starting to talk about how infographics can be spammy because people are kind of creating crap infographics just for the links. So
right.
You have to be careful. You have to create high quality. But that's a great example of where if you have a little bit of money, it helps tremendously because you can – just doing the research to create an infographic is tremendously time consuming. And if you can hire someone to do that, and often a copywriter is able to do that fairly well. The people who I was working with on my blog posts, I would say, you know, here's a topic, go out and find a bunch of cool stats that we can put into an infographic. And again, that might cost you $50 or $100 to do it. If you have a bunch of time, you can do it yourself and spend the several hours. Then you do have to hire a designer and then you could launch it.
Okay.
That's another non-scalable. The other thing I did is I did a podcasting tour. I did kind of a press tour of all the podcasts that are in my target market. So you can't just pick random podcasts. You have to pick something dealing with, you know, the market that you're trying to go after. Totally doesn't scale, but it's a great way to, you spend 30 minutes, 45 minutes talking to someone on a podcast and you get 5 or 10 trial signups. You know, you get 5 or 10 sales of your downloadable software. So you're just building up that momentum, trying to get more and more people to hear about it. And then moving on, another step is to start doing integrations. And that's great. You integrate with Basecamp. You integrate with, you know, with Hittail's example, where we have an integration we just finished with HubSpot. We're not going to launch it until January because the holidays are slow. But HubSpot is a, you know, marketing platform, and Hittail helps marketers. We also developed a WordPress plugin. Sorry, go ahead.
For those people who don't know about integration, can you talk about a little bit about the APIs and without getting too technical?
Sure. Yeah, so an API is just a way for your software code to talk to another application. So for an example, Basecamp is project management software. Am I right? Yeah, Basecamp is project management. I didn't write the integration. My product manager did. So it helps manage to-dos and projects and people. And so with Hittail, we give you keywords that can go into a to-do list. And so we said, hey, let's make your to-dos one-click transfer into Basecamp. And so using their little API, we can just, you know, spit a bunch of data into your Basecamp account. You log into it and boom, all your, you know, it says write an article for this keyword. That's now your to-do list. So, you know, it can be much more complex than that. With the HubSpot integration, we actually, almost the entire Hittail, all the panels of Hittail exist now in HubSpot. So right in your dashboard, you can flip through all the different panels of Hittail. So that was a little more complex.
Does Trello have an API? Because that would be very useful for me. And anything that sends stuff into Trello would be great for me.
I agree. I'm actually now a devoted user of Trello as well. I don't know if they have an API.
Yeah, I don't think they do yet.
They need to get it out, because you're right. I would love to be able to one click and put stuff into there. Yeah, so that's the summary. I mean, those are what integrations are. They're non-trivial to build. You definitely need someone who knows code, and you have to build it. But the beauty is then, you know, with Basecamp, we'd hoped to get kind of like a blog post on their product blog, not the 37 Signals blog, but just the company product blog. But it turns out shut that blog down like a year or two ago. So all we got, I think we got a tweet, and then we get listed on their integrations page. And that's nice. It sends monthly recurring traffic, comes back, and that, you know, converts into trials. And then the HubSpot one, we have higher hopes for. I think we will get a blog post and some other promotion. And that's really valuable, because you're then marketing. You're not just marketing on a random blog. You're marketing, you know, you get a guest spot on HubSpot's blog, which is like tens of thousands of marketers who are willing to spend money on software are now going to read about Hittail. So there's a lot of there.
Yeah, that is incredibly valuable. And I guess you could probably go through and do like the PR people do and make an estimation of how much that traffic's worth if you had to go pay for it somewhere else.
I know exactly how much it would be worth, depending on how much it comes through. I know the number depending on how it converts once it comes in, I know exactly how much I can pay for a trial. And that is a very valuable thing to know, because you can then justify, you know, if you pay, let's say you pay $500 to have an infographic designed, and you pay $100 for a writer to gather the sources, and then you spend a couple hours of your time doing the marketing, the tweeting, you know, encouraging people to market it, I can add all that up and I know exactly how much that quote unquote cost me, right? In either time or money.
Okay.
And I will have any URL surrounding that, linking from that, will have a unique code so that in Google Analytics, I can see the traffic's coming from there. It's not 100% effective, because sure, somebody could type in my domain name directly or
right.
They could traffic, but I can typically see that spike that's going to be a same day spike. Then I will go into Google Analytics. I have a conversion goal set up and I can see how many trials came from that infographic. And if I didn't get, you know, X dollars per trial, if I'm not under that number, then I know that I've made a bad investment and I either need to do a better job on the next infographic or I will stop doing infographics. That's
okay.
Measurable marketing. I'm doing that with everything. Our integrations, I know exactly how much money we spent on the Basecamp integration and I know exactly how many customers we've got from it. So far, it has not paid itself back, but customers are still coming in. So it's like, what's your time horizon at that point? You know, that's the question I have to ask.
So with your cost per lead and cost per customer that you're determining how much you're able to spend on them, are you doing it based on total lifetime value or just based on a certain time period, like a year?
It's a very good question. So I'm not doing it on lifetime value, and I encourage people not to do lifetime value because often it takes a year or more to get that money back, especially with a subscription service. Even venture-funded startups that have a lot of money in the bank, they try not to go out beyond 12 months. And they also try not to go out beyond 1/3 of your lifetime value. That's a general rule. So even if you have a 3-year lifetime, you kind of want to stay under 1 year. It's general. You can, if you want to be aggressive, you can go out to 18 months or 2 years, but man, you got to wait a long time to get your money back. And a lot of investors won't want to do that. For bootstrap startups or bootstrap software companies, my recommendation is to stay between 2 and 4 months of payback, essentially. So 2 and 4 months of average monthly revenue is where I recommend. And if you have more money in the bank, you can push that out to 4 or 5. But as I know, start at between 2 and 3.
The way I've always liked to figure it is based upon my annual profit off of that customer. So if I know my averages and I know what the profit that I'm going to make from that, that's as much as I can spend. So if my profit is going to be $100 that year, then I know I can spend up to $100 to acquire a new customer because after I get past that 1 year point, I'm going to be making money. Right. That allows me to stay within cash flow. So I'm not having to come out of pocket every month to keep the business going. And then after that 1 year, now I'm making my profit back.
Right. Now the only danger with doing that is if they're paying you $8 a month, then yeah, it's going to be $96 a year. Okay. And let's assume it's $8 of net profit that maybe they're paying you $12 a month and you have support costs, you have whatever other payment processing factored in there. So they're really getting, you're really netting $8 a month from them. You do need to wait all 12 months to get it back. So if you spent $90 in the first month, you have to have some cash to get that, right? So if you bought 100 customers for $90 a piece, you would need $9,000 that first month out of pocket. And that's okay. You know, as long as you know that their lifetime is longer than 12 months and that you can front that money each month. And that's how you'll grow fastest, is if you really do, you know, kind of muscle up to it and invest some money into your idea. Now I wouldn't recommend spending $90 because that's too much, right? You want to have your limit. My limit, if I had $100 lifetime value or $100 annual value, I would be most comfortable right around, that depends, somewhere between $20 and $40 spending that upfront per customer, because I know that I will make that back in 3 to 5 months, I guess.
Right. Right. Yeah. And this is based upon having some data already.
Yep.
So you can't say, it's going to cost me, I'm going to make $100 a year in profit off of this customer, if you are just starting, because you literally have no idea.
You're exactly right. And you You need not only to get some data, but it's nice to, that's where that early cash flow I was talking about, where, you know, you do the podcast tour, you do guest posts, you do all this stuff that doesn't scale, because if you can get a recurring stream of revenue, even a few $1,000, you now have money to play with where you can take some risks. Or if you can do a one-time promo, like I did AppSumo, which is a, you know, daily deals for web geeks. And that brought in, I don't think I'm allowed to say, but let's just say it brought in low five figures of net profit to me. That was just a nice little bucket of money that I could then go out and be dangerous with. And I could buy ads and be a little reckless and test things. And I spent several $1,000, but I nailed it after a while. And early on, my cost to acquire was way high, but I had the luxury of that several $1,000 cushion to then hone the ad campaigns and hone, you know, my whole conversion funnel and get it to where that is an actual, that's one of my flywheels now. It's a sustainable long-term approach that works every month, and I invest several $1,000s into it, and I gain a lot of customers for smaller than that, than my magic number that I need to hit.
Okay, so when you relaunched Hittail after you bought it and cleaned it up a bit and put a little polish on it, did you have a marketing budget set aside for it? Because you're talking about things that are more labor intensive, like getting interviewed and getting posts out and things like that. That's more labor intensive versus money intensive. So were there any things that you were doing? Did you go out and start doing some advertising? If you knew you were going to be on a blog, did you buy some advertising space to go along with it?
So I'm a bootstrapper by trade, and I've just tended to not spend a lot of money on marketing in general. I've just always invested time, maybe hired people to help me, but I didn't go out and do a lot of ad buys. What I noticed with Hittail and what I'm going to do with future products is that once I did the stuff that didn't scale, once I got that out of the way and I had money coming in every month, the bank balance was going up. And I looked at this bucket of money, and especially after I did the AppSumo deal, I started in January with the relaunch, and AppSumo was in June or July. I looked at my bank balance and I said, I need to invest this somewhere. I have this money. I'm either going to put it in the stock market. I'm not going to put it into a CD or something that gives me one. do the stock market, or I'm going to buy another startup, which is kind of my thing, or somehow invest this in something. And I was looking at Hittail and thought, Hittail's working. Like, I know the lifetime value. I know the numbers now after 4 or 5 months. How can I plunge a bunch of this money into Hittail so that it multiplies, right? It's like putting a dollar into a machine and having it give you $2 or $3 out 5 months down the line. Well, you're going to put as much money into that as you can. So that's what I was looking for, was that flywheel that you can put that dollar in and get more out on the other end. And that's when I started investing money and became more aggressive with it, and I wanted to grow it fast. And so that included advertising. That also included what else did I do? Yeah, I did. I bought some. I guess it was mostly advertising. Oh, I started pushing hard on infographic stuff. I started funding integrations quicker. You know, I hired a part-time who then became a full-time product manager on the app. And to me, I see that as an investment, because he is now doing more marketing than I could alone. So all of that is just reinvesting into the app. And I have a concrete ROI that I look at each month to make sure that it's all working. And if it isn't, then I'm going to shut one of them down. But each of those things you could do yourself, you could just work more hours, but that's not how I choose to do it these days. You know, it's a time versus money equation. And if you have more of one than the other, then that's what you should invest.
Yeah, I like money for its ability to buy more time.
Indeed. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So with that, you're saying the bank account's going up. So I'm assuming that this reinvestment, that you were putting the reinvestment back in without taking a salary from Hittail. Is that true?
Yes. Well, yeah, I guess I don't. See, I have other apps that I live on, you know? I mean, I have .NET Invoice I mentioned, but I have a whole I have 10 different software products. And so, I guess software and some info products. So, I wasn't taking a salary from Hittail. I could at this point, but I'm just reinvesting the money. There's no reason for me to I don't need a lot of things.
Right. Well, the reason I brought that up was that someone who's trying to build up their own software business, that they may need some other source of income to be or at least a savings account. So because they're probably going to be running negative for a while cash flow wise, where they're needing to reinvest in the company as opposed to spending it on their rent or something.
Right. Yeah. If I was building Hittail 5 or 6 years ago when I still was working full time as a consultant, I would have done it slightly differently. I couldn't have been as aggressive as I was, but I would have still gone down the same path. I would have done the stuff that didn't scale. I would have built up a little bit of money. Then I would have dropped down to part-time work. So I would have tried to work 2 or 3 days a week as a consultant and filled that in so I had now more time to market and leverage. And I would have slowly bought my time out as I grew Hittail. And then eventually I would have quit my job, and I wouldn't have been able to hire that product manager, and I wouldn't have been able to be as aggressive with the ads, but I would still, like you said, have been using that money to buy my time. And then eventually I'd get to the same point. It's just going to take you longer, you know, if you don't have the capital to kind of do it the way I did. But I did exactly what I'm talking about with other products 5 years ago when I slowly stair-stepped down from consulting. And I did that with .NET Invoice, a site called CMS Themer, an e-commerce site called Just Beach Towels. I mean, I cobbled all those together and slowly bought my time out until I was able to quit consulting. And that was truly a miraculous thing because it was all nights and weekends. You know, you do it for nights and weekends for so long and you're building these businesses. And the day you quit and I got up and I remember I had a cup of coffee and I looked and I was like, it's 8 o'clock. I have nothing to do all day. Like, I can build my businesses or not, but I had so much more time and my businesses just rocketed at that point because I had so much more time that I was able to invest. And
well, not just time, but energy, because you're not spending your best energy on someone else's work.
True. Your good glucose is Dan Anderson.
Yeah.
It's legitimate. You only have so much in your day-to-day life where you burn through it. And if you have it to invest in your products, they will grow faster than when you don't.
All right. I got one last question. So with APIs, it's kind of an informal strategic alliance where you're integrating with other people's software. Have you gone out to do a formal partnership, a formal strategic alliance with people who have your target market as their customers?
Yes. And those, so I refer to them as JV partnerships or joint venture partnerships. And they're very loose, right? It's a strategic partnership, but there's no contract. We email. I'll email the CEO of an SEO rank tracking tool and say, hey, I run Hittail. You know, I have this many customers. I'm interested in perhaps doing a mailing to my audience. You can do mailing to yours. So yes, I have one of those in the works for January, and I plan to do probably 3 or 4 more next year. I haven't actually executed on one yet. Those are they aren't super scalable because it's a lot of time. But I would like to figure out a way for my product manager to handle more of that so that I don't need to be involved with it.
Yeah, because it was very popular in software back in the day where you wanted to get your software already pre-installed on a box.
Got it.
And which is a formal, you know, it's a very formal relationship. Contracts are involved in those things. And a lot of people, I just don't see very many people doing that anymore. I see some informal stuff like JVs where you're just like, hey, I'll promote your stuff, you promote mine. Yeah, great. But I don't see too many people doing that anymore, except for in the mobile world where, like, I've got T-Mobile and my Android phone is full of useless pieces of software that you can't get rid of unless you root the phone.
I think that may be why most people aren't doing it anymore, because it's not optimal for the customer. You know, it does tend to opt you into things you may not want. I do know of there's a few places that do it a little more. It's not just a JV thing, but it is ongoing. Like, you can get on discount pages, pro perks pages on SEO Moz. I don't remember if I signed a contract for that or not, but they just promote our stuff. They don't, it's weird because the installation thing isn't exactly, the paradigm doesn't transfer, right, with web apps. Because it's like you said, you would forget to check a box and then it would install something on your hardware. And that paradigm doesn't exactly transfer these days. I do know that, let me think. There are some people talking about doing co-registration things. Like, if you're signing up for my SaaS app, there's just a checkbox and you can get this other SaaS app. You can get a membership to that using these same credentials.
Right.
I wouldn't do that because I'd be concerned that people would forget to uncheck the box and they're now getting tricked into signing up for my app. And I don't want that. You know,
well, you would want to make sure that the boxes aren't pre-checked. That would be important. And then also have a confirmation process afterwards to verify that they really did want it. Even if they accidentally checked the box and then were like, I don't remember this. Why are you spamming me?
That's right. Right. Yeah. You just need to be really certain that someone wants your service before you get them to sign up.
So, because I can't help myself. I always get into consultant mode because I look at something like your business where it's related to search traffic. Well, where would I need to go? Well, website owners who want to manage and grow their search rankings through the data that they can acquire from you. Well, then I would want to be going out and creating alliances with people who have my target market already in play.
Right. And to be honest, I emailed 9 different SEO tools, the one that are complements to Hittail essentially. And I expected to hear back from 1 or 2. I got 9 replies from the owners, from the CEOs and owners who all said, yes, let's do this. And what we decided, one, I couldn't handle all that, right? It's just really, they're quite time consuming to put together, even as just a JV mailing.
Right.
But what I decided is to try to do 1 per month, maybe 1 every 2 months, just to not, you know, overwhelm my folks. And the ones that are most successful, I want to then dive in deeper, right? So if I send a mailing out and a lot of people from Hittail convert or a lot of people from their service convert, that to me, that's a sign to now figure out, oh, we need to do an API, you know, an integration, a deeper integration where I can export from Hittail into your rank tracker or you can go the other way.
Right.
So I agree with you, and that's like already in progress. It's just another thing. It isn't scaling really well, and I have other things that are, so I've been focusing more on those. But 2013 should bring around at least a few of the partnerships that you're talking about.
Well, and that, yeah, and you're right. These kind of things, partnerships don't scale. They're very high friction activities. You need to spend a lot of time with them, hence needing somebody who, like a product manager, you need a staff to be able to grow to that next level. That because if you can then acquire thousands of other customers through just one activity, then it ends up being very worth it. It doesn't scale on the front end, but on the back end it does.
Yep, that's right.
All right. So I literally could go on for a long time because this is one of my very most favorite topics to be ever talking about. And I will reduce my nerdiness on that and say, Rob, what kind of words of wisdom can you dump on our listeners here that is just going to rock their world and get them out there and marketing their own software?
I think the one thing I'll say is if you're going to go after building software, to start with something fairly small, get an early win. Don't try to build something for a year or two and spend a lot of time in a basement. And it makes it so easy to waste time when you can push off that inevitable launch day. Information products are actually kind of nice in that respect because you can spend a month or two and then you can fail quick. Whereas software, people tend to use this excuse that, oh, we're in development, we're building this great thing. But it's so easy to kill a lot of time and a lot of money doing that. So I'd say get something out there early. Even consider, instead of building a full-fledged SaaS app, build a WordPress plugin version of that first because it's smaller, it's easier to get out. Figure out if people want it. Have some successes to build your confidence, to learn about your market, and to learn about the best ways to market this thing. Then slowly expand over time, yeah, as you have the time and money to do so.
Fantastic, fantastic. So, Rob, where can people address any questions they got for you?
Sure. Probably the best place to find me these days is on my podcast, Startups for the Rest of Us. And you can search for startups in iTunes and it'll come up in the top few, or you can go to startupsfortherestofus.com. We talk about, Mike and I, who's my co-host, we talk about this kind of stuff pretty much every week. We have a 30 to 40 minute show where we address it. And I'm also working on a new startup I'd like to mention. It's called Drip. And if you go to getdrip.com, it's basically an email marketing SaaS app, and it's going to help people convert more website visitors into customers.
Nice. Nice. I'm definitely going to go check that out. You just surprised me there. I didn't know that was coming. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited about that. I'll go check that out as soon as we get off here.
Very cool. It's just a landing page these days, but we're in development and have several people who are willing to pay for it. So we're excited.
Well, see, I think that's a good instructive process there. Go check out what Rob's doing for a brand new piece of software.
Indeed.
And follow the process.
I'm going to be pulling out all the stops and doing all the tricks of the trade. And well, not tricks, but just, you know, the marketing stuff. I mean, by observing what I do, you can definitely be learning from that, because I'm going to be putting the pedal to the metal on this one.
Very cool. Very cool. So, everyone listening, I hope you've gotten a lot of value from this episode and got past me geeking out over talking about marketing software, and you're able to put this into action. So until the next time,
enjoy your foolish adventure.
You've just listened to the Foolish Adventure Show with Tim Conley. To get more straight talk about making money online and building a successful internet business, go to foolishadventure.com. There, you can opt into the Freedom File newsletter. You'll also get access to the Foolish Guide to Launching Products video training module, over an hour and 20 minutes of business building knowledge that can generate tens of thousands of dollars for your new product. Enjoy your Foolish Adventure.